Welcome to Deeper Questions. Submerge in wonder, surface with hope. My name is Aaron Johnstone, and today we're asking the question, does religion help or hurt social justice? Helen Keller once said, although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it. And today, we want to look at this confrontation between pain and comfort, distress and reprieve, suffering and solace, wounds and bandages, storm and safety. We're talking social justice, activism, charity, causes, not-for-profits, and some of the reasons why these things exist in the first place. And we'll get specific too, and spend a good chunk on gambling reform in Australia, but also global aid, homelessness, addiction, immigration, and other issues in our modern world. On top of that, we'll discuss the role of religion in these things, and whether faith is a net positive in building a better world, or whether it hinders these efforts. And to do that, I'm sure many of you will already know today's guest. We have the Reverend, the Advocate, the Social Conscience, and National Treasure, Tim Costello.
Elon Musk on the Joe Rogan podcast said, "The fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy." Now, as a Christian, I believe the Christian gospel and Jesus has been a profound shaping influence on Western civilization. I would say the fundamental strength of Western civilization is empathy.
Reverend Tim Costello, AO, is an Australian Baptist minister, social justice advocate, and former CEO of World Vision Australia. A lawyer by training, he previously served as Mayor of St Kilda and Executive Director of Urban Seed, working on homelessness and addiction issues in Melbourne. He's also been the Chief Advocate for World Vision Australia, Chair of the Community Council for Australia, Executive Director of Micah Australia, and a Senior Fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity. Throughout his career, Costello has been a leading voice on poverty, gambling reform, and social justice, frequently speaking on ethical leadership and public policy. His contributions have been widely recognised, including being named Victorian of the Year in 2004 and being appointed an Officer of the Order of Australia in 2005 for his service to the community. He even won the 2008 Australian Peace Prize. I could go on, but I should probably start our episode at some point, so let me welcome you to the show. It's great to have you, Tim Costello.
Thank you. Thoroughly researched. I didn't even know or remember quite all of that myself. Well done.
Well, good we could walk through memory lane together. Let's start with a milestone that you've recently reflected on. So you turned 70 this year and you wrote a lovely little piece about that and being a grandparent. It mentions kind of enchanting your grandkids with a fox and that was writing them letters. So it reminds me of kind of Fantastic Mr. Fox living on your property, something like that. Anyway, 70 years is quite the achievement. And you say that you're happier than you've ever been. So we'd all like to know, what's your secret there, Tim?
Well, thank you for asking. If I had imagined hitting 70 and thinking I'd be happier than ever, I would say, gosh, I must have dementia. I must have lost my marbles. You don't, with the elixir of youth, aspire to being a 70-year-old and... I was reminded of what a big number it was. So many of my friends, they all said the same thing. They said, wow, 70, how do you feel? I felt exactly the same.
Yep.
I didn't feel any different.
Youthful in spirit.
But so many of them said it to me, I started to wonder, should I be feeling something? And of course, it's a big number. Look, I have been married to the same woman for 46 years, and I'm planning to stay with her to the end. And that's one of the, I think, the great secrets of success. And, you know, it's interesting to think that we met at school when we were 17, were married at 24. What did we know about life? And here we are, having done life and family, friendship, deep love, deep commitment, and you know, the ancient Greeks would say friendship is the greatest gift, and I think they're right. And when that friend happens to be your life partner who has been there through ups and downs, that is the great gift. It is an extraordinary gift. You know, having 70 years makes you start to think, is there many more? And if I died tomorrow, I would actually be very grateful. I feel I've lived a blessed life. Now, I don't want to die tomorrow.
No.
I've got 5 grandchildren. I'm loving the stage of life. Curiously, I find myself more interested in them at their ages, 6 down to 9 months, than I was with my own kids at that age.
Yeah.
And I'm going to ask the Almighty if there's a design fault. You know, I'd be a much wiser parent if I had kids now. When I had kids, you're financially insecure, you're professionally insecure, you're trying to make it. When your kids need you most, it's all happening at once. I'd be a much, much wiser parent now. But I suspect the Almighty would say, yeah, but you don't have the energy now.
Yeah, it's a trade-off.
So I think that's the reason.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, a few months ago, I was at a friend's house in Sydney, and I was browsing his bookshelf, and he actually had a copy of your first book, Streets of Hope, Finding God in St Kilda. And just for the record, I'm guessing you're not talking about the Saints footy club.
No. Unfortunately, I barrack for Essendon.
There you go. But anyway, I had a flick through, and I'm now kicking myself that I didn't borrow it in that moment or just pluck it off the shelf. But I suspect that many of these experiences were pretty key for you becoming someone concerned with social action and compassion for the vulnerable at a fairly earlier stage of your career. Can you tell us a bit about those early moments and why these issues came to you and why you decided to get involved in that sort of stuff?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The experiences in St Kilda set me up for everything I have done since. So I was a lawyer who opened a legal practice in the church. I preached for this small congregation, less than 10 people, all over 80 on a Sunday, but I was working as a lawyer. One woman who walked in, middle-aged, married, 3 kids, didn't smoke or drink, never had even had a traffic fine, is sitting in my legal office asking me to represent her because she'd stolen $60,000 from her employer. She had stolen because pokies had just been introduced to our state, and really without any consumer warning, she had got addicted. Pokies are very predatory. The dopamine release when you sit in front of that machine with the lights and bells hits the pleasure center of the brain with the force of cocaine. I went to defend her. She was given 4 years jail. I went to visit her in Tarangawa Women's Prison. And I asked myself, how does a middle-aged woman who's never even had a traffic fine end up in prison for 4 years?
Yeah.
So back in 1995, that woman walking into the legal office started me looking at gambling in Australia, which I've pursued for reform for 30 years. In ministry, I believed I had my life together and was a generous, loving person. And there was a woman, Indigenous woman, would play the piano by ear and would often play in our services. She and the other street people would have to walk out after 10 minutes to have a smoke, but then they'd come back in for the service and she'd play the piano. She, her name was Eva, and she was literally the Mother Teresa of the streets of St Kilda. There was a lot of homeless, mentally ill, drug addicted sex workers on the streets of St Kilda when we started in 1984. And I watch Eva, who had a strong Christian faith, give away her last $5. And I realized I, as a Christian, thinking I'm generous, would never do that. And I said, where are you going to get the money for the next 3 or 4 days? How are you going to survive, Eva? And she'd say, God will provide. That person was in need. And I suddenly thought, who has got real faith? Who actually trusts here? Eva actually taught me a whole lot about my faith. So a whole lot of the experiences in my first ministry really reframed how I think about both my faith, what issues like gambling I pursue. Those St Kilda days were very influential.
Yeah, I bet. And over the years, you've been placed in quite a number of positions to make a difference. So yeah, you just shared a bit about your law work there, but you also did a stint in politics as we opened with, but also as the CEO of World Vision Australia. So can you tell us some of the things that you learned through these experiences?
Yeah, it was, again, reading my Bible in St Kilda, where homelessness and people were being forced out of their rentals by new money, discovering St Kilda, why have we left this to poor people when it's on the beach and it's 5 kilometres from Melbourne. And so they were buying houses, heritage colours, forcing the poor out. I was reading my Bible. And Isaiah 65 said, they shall build houses and live in them. No longer shall they build houses and others live in them. And I thought God spoke to me. I said, what am I dealing with? People who have lived in workmen's cottages for generations here in St Kilda who can't afford to live here anymore. So I ran for council. I ran and got elected as mayor. I ran on a platform of affordable or social housing, putting St Kilda ratepayers' dollars into buying affordable housing for long-term St Kilda residents who are poor, who are being forced down. I read that passage at my inauguration as mayor of St Kilda. They shall build houses and live in them. No longer shall they build houses and others live in them. And I saw a whole lot of my secular political colleagues rolling their eyes, oh my gosh, we've got a Bible basher now. But those days in St Kilda taught me that actually there is a direct link from faith to pulling some levers of public policy and local government. After St Kilda and being a minister at Connor Street Baptist and starting Urban Seed that work with homeless and drug affected people, I discovered that World Vision tapped me on the shoulder and invited me to be the CEO. The Collins Street Baptist Urban Seed years were very powerful years in plunging again into the issue of people have terrible addictions.
Yeah.
We started a detox centre still running today called The First Step. People on the street sometimes find more community on the street because they have come from families, as one young person put it to me, his parents were both professionals and he'd left, got addicted to drugs, was sleeping on the streets. He said, my parents are so busy, they have to have a diary to put in a note to see their friends. Nobody drops by. Nobody's ever home. There's more community here on the streets. Yeah. So I started in those years, post the St Kilda years, the next decade really, with Urban Seed at Collins Street Baptist, where I was the minister, learning about the deepest needs and hungers and longing of humans just to answer the question, do I matter?
Yeah.
Does anybody notice me? Well, that question was pivotal at World Vision. You know, World Vision, I had 500 staff, $400 million budget. And the question was, do the poorest, most vulnerable people in the world matter? And World Vision was unequivocally saying yes. Mm. God sees you. Australians who sponsor a child and give see you. You matter. Your daughters, you know, when I started 20 years ago at World Vision, it was less than 40% of girls going to primary school. Mm. Today it's 80% of girls going to primary school, getting a chance, knowing that they matter, that they have skills. With schooling, they can set up an agency. It's amazing how education for girls is like a contraceptive. For every year you stay in school, you have 1.2 less babies because you say, I actually have choices and skills and can meet some of my dreams, not just married off at 14.
Yeah.
So World Vision really was a wonderful experience, and it continues today with World Vision to answer the question that the most vulnerable, who drew the last ticket in the lottery of life. You know, if you were born here in Australia, none of us choose to be born. But here we are thrown up in a country with universal health, universal education, clean water, a chance that we can flourish. But the last ticket in the lottery of life is many of the African countries, Southeast Asian countries, East Timor, Pacific nations that I visited in World Vision. And to say that people there who drew the last ticket in the lottery of life matter to God, to me, to others, was just a rare privilege.
Yeah. Ah, oh, incredible. And on top of these experiences that you've gone into, I'd like to hear more about like the role faith plays in your motivations. So do you have like particularly key texts or ideas from the Bible that kind of have been a guiding light for you over these years, as well as any maybe Christian historical figures that have stood out to you?
Yeah, I'm probably best known as an advocate, a Baptist minister who happens to be an advocate on a range of issues. Advocacy is often a militant term for people, a political term. It's about conflict or stridency. I realized early on reading the Bible that advocacy starts right at the beginning of the story, Genesis 1. Mm-hmm. God spoke and separated the light from darkness. God spoke and separated chaos and provided order. God spoke, and advocacy speaking is creative. Mm. It actually creates an alternative space where there can be protection and meaningful work and opportunity. And so advocacy for me started right there in the Bible. As I read my Bible, I realized that the Hebrew prophets, I now work for an organization called Micah, and it takes its name from the Hebrew prophet Micah, and its motto is, what does God require of us? You know, it's not too often that direct question is asked, actually, in Scripture. Very direct, what does God require of us? Mm. But to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. And those Hebrew prophets who cried out for the widow, the orphan, the refugee, who was called the Bible, and called the stranger in the Bible, they confronted kings, they confronted unjust systems, they confronted greed. And I realized that Jesus, who I believe is the Son of God, and Paul, who wrote a lot of the New Testament, Jesus and Paul stood in the shoes of these prophets, announcing a good news for the poor, announcing a multicultural vision.
Yeah.
You know, if you read the end of the Bible, Revelation chapter 7, it's about all tongues, all tribes, all languages together, living in peace in a new Jerusalem, a city without walls because there aren't enemies. People who actually fight tribally, and we're living in a world that's re-tribalizing, make America great again, make Russia great again, make China great again. Actually, my Christian faith said, make the world great again, for God so loved the world, and people can live together, and they can know who to serve. In my faith, that's the true God, who actually loves us. So for me, advocacy and believing that I can make a difference because of my faith here and now have been fundamental.
Mm, wonderful. Well, let's move into some of the specific areas that you're passionate about. The first being the one that you're probably most well known for at the moment, and which you've shared a bit about already, and that is speaking out against the gambling industry. In the past, you've said that it's like our version of the NRA, so the National Rifle Association in America, and the gun lobby there. Can you explain a bit about what you meant by that? And just give us a bit of a snapshot of how bad gambling is in Australia.
Yeah. So the American population overwhelmingly want gun reform after so many massacres. The nation is crying out for gun reform. Why can't they get gun reform? Because the National Rifle Association and its capture of politicians is so powerful, unbelievably powerful. And I know in this country it was easier to get gun reform because we didn't have an NRA. I was part of that whole movement supporting John Howard to get gun reform. I addressed the biggest crowd in my life, over 250,000 people in Melbourne, marching for gun reform, and we got it. We have not got any gambling reform. The parallel with the NRA is America's blind spot is guns. We all look at America and we go, how can they not reform guns? The rest of the world looks at Australia, where we have the greatest gambling losses in the world, that's per capita, 40% higher than the nation that comes second, which is Singapore. Oh. The rest of the world says, how can they not get any reform? And the answer is that literally the gambling companies, the vested interests, have captured AFL and NRL. They wholly own them. Those football codes now really are gambling companies with over $60, $70 million a year coming from gambling with the football as a subsidiary.
Yeah.
They have captured the broadcasters, 7, 9, 10, and Foxtel. And nearly two and a half years ago, a very brave Labor backbencher led an inquiry into gambling. Her name was Peter Murphy. I say brave because she lost her fight with cancer and died at 50. Mm. The recommendation of her committee, backed by the two Liberals, the National, the Independents, the Greens, and two Labor, was unanimous to ban gambling ads. And European nations have done this. We have a million gambling ads a year on free-to-air TV, something like 900 a day on free-to-air TV.
Oh, wow.
European nations have banned them, saying we're not going to let our kids be groomed with gambling ads and our sports be captured and owned by gambling ads. Hmm. FA, Football Association, runs the what we call soccer football in UK. 4 years ago, totally disconnected from any gambling ads and sponsorship, but not our AFL, not our NRL. In fact, the NRL this year and last year had its first season, first opening round in Las Vegas. Why? For gambling money. That's why they're in Las Vegas. Mm. So the Peter Murphy report was unanimous. I thought, wow, unanimous. With 80% of Australians wanting a ban on gambling ads, we are going to get some action. Neither Anthony Albanese, and it was a chair of his own party, the chair was of his own party, nor Peter Dutton, and two of Libs are on it, even have responded to the Murphy report. Mm-hmm. Not even a response since it was handed down.
Yeah.
And the reason is very simple. You say, well, if 80% of the public want it. The latest AFL fan survey was 76% of AFL fans want all the gambling ads banned. Mm. Surely a democracy works in the way that leaders follow what the people want. Isn't that the principle of democracy? No, no, no. Not when you have a vested interest as powerful as the NRA is in America. Mm. They have completely defeated any reform. So in this election we're going into... you won't be hearing the major parties talking about gambling reform.
No.
Dropped like a stone.
Yeah. And, just as you're talking about there, like I'm thinking about the ads, that is a surprisingly high amount of support to get rid of gambling ads. Because one of the things that you notice with these gambling ads is that they're very schmick and very like funny a lot of the time. They get the superstars. Like I'm thinking of Shaquille O'Neal and Allen Iverson doing these high profile ads for them. And they've really, like, it seems like they're really trying to kind of insert and inception themselves into the male Australian psyche that it's normal to watch the footy with mates, to have a drink, to place a bet. It's all harmless fun, part of being a larrikin, but also potentially easy money being earned. Like, I'm just thinking there, like, because you can gamble on just about anything these days. Like, famously, you could gamble over, like, whether Liz Truss would outlast a vegetable and other politicians in the UK.
No, lettuce, that's right.
Yeah, lettuce, yeah. I'd love to know, like, in your mind, with the different types of gambling, Do you see that there's like maybe a bit of a hierarchy in terms of which forms of gambling are more destructive, more addictive, more insidious, or do you kind of rank them all pretty similarly?
Yeah, so until the last 10 years, pokies were the reason we had the greatest losses and are still largely the reason. So Australians lose $32 billion a year in gambling. It's more than NDIS. It's more than aged care. It's extra. It's far more than our defence budget. It's extraordinary. Pokies were the problem because, unlike anywhere else in the world, Australian states literally said we can rake in revenue if we allow pokies to go everywhere. So Australia has 75% of all the world's pokies in pubs and clubs, 75%. Most of the world's pokies are in casinos, which I don't have as big a problem with, because a casino is a destination gambling opportunity. You intended to go to the casino. You know you've got to get home. You therefore think a bit about, you know, what can I afford to lose? What's this night out going to cost me?
Yeah.
Because pokies are in pubs and clubs on every fourth or fifth block in Australia, you weren't intending to gamble. You were intending to shop.
Yeah.
You've got an extra half an hour on the parking meter. There's always a pokies venue open. They are so accessible. In fact, two Productivity Commission reports into gambling said we have the greatest losses because we have the greatest gambling accessibility. That's why. And the machines are built for addiction. There's no doubt about that. Look, getting reform on pokies was hard because it's still less than 30% of the population that play pokies. What happened in the last 10 years with sports betting was 100% of the population see the sports betting gambling ads, and parents are furious. Parents say, it's hard enough to protect my child, but we're sitting down to watch the footy and my child is asking about the odds, or 10-year-olds are talking at school about Hawthorn playing Essendon and the odds on the match, the odds on the who will kick the first goal. You know, 80% of 10-year-olds in Australia know the logos, jingles and the odds from different sports betting companies. Yeah. 80% of kids.
It's just interwoven, isn't
it? Now, if 80% of kids knew the difference between Peter Stuyvesant cigarettes or Marlboro cigarettes, as they did once when, you know, cricket was sponsored, Benson and Hedges cricket, we'd say, well, cigarettes are legal, but it's an adult product, and that's why we banned it. Likewise with alcohol. We have limited the ads that's not sponsoring sport. You can't have an ad in the 6 o'clock commercial news for alcohol, but you can have gambling ads, and we do. In other words, gambling has this incredible capture on our politicians at federal level. Unbelievable capture. I've never seen anything like it. It's why I liken it to the NRA. When parents have a psychic vomit every time they're watching the sport and a gambling ad comes on with their kids. And I am stopped literally every week by complete strangers who recognize me saying how angry they are, how helpless they feel as parents protecting their kids. We know that if there's gambling in a family, there's four times more domestic violence. It's a massive fueler of violence.
Yeah.
We know that our courts are clogged with gambling addictions and people who stole to feed their addiction. We know that it is absolutely predatory in an anxious generation where mental health increases are on the rise because it says gamble with your mates. They own mateship. They own community. So it is young men, but it's 100% of the population who are going, how come no one will do anything about this?
Well, I'm definitely going to add psychic vomit to my lexicon. Haven't heard that one before. But, yes, understandable. It's, yeah, beyond infuriating. So another question related to gambling, we've got a couple more. What do you make of the rise of new forms of online gambling in particular? And here I'm talking about speculative digital markets. So things you might have heard like loot boxes, obviously crypto is a big one at the moment, NFTs, non-fungible tokens, virtual real estate in the metaverse. And then we could even throw in there, like this is precedes the internet, but just like the stock market in general.
Yeah.
What do you take of those forms of, like could they be considered forms of gambling?
So the definition about gambling is that if I win, my joy is only because someone else lost.
Mm.
It's a zero-sum game.
Yep.
The stock market hasn't been, I would never call gambling, because by definition, investing in the stock market can grow a bigger pie,
mm.
and notionally everyone can win.
Yep.
The pie with gambling is zero-sum. A win is because someone else is devastated and they lost. That is the definition of gambling.
Yeah.
Look, I'm very worried that gambling and cryptocurrency seem to go together, particularly with young men. The AFL is sponsored by both. And it's particularly, in theory, cryptocurrency is more like the stock market. You don't necessarily have a win, increase your return because there's a loss somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I'm careful about saying, therefore, it is gambling. Look, loot boxes, we thought we had successfully got laws to stop under 15-year-olds being able to play loot boxes, but I did a Channel 10 news report just last week about 300,000 under 15-year-olds in Australia. I'm just struggling to remember what the game was. It had some, you know, name, but it's an extraordinarily attractive game, and it's loot boxes and it's gambling. It's actually really teaching them a free-to-play platform, but then you commit money once you're on the platform and in, and it's aimed at kids. That definitely is gambling. There's no question about that.
Yeah, and it taps into that kind of, I guess it's a different form, isn't it, where it's a fear of missing out kind of thing.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. And you know, I'm putting my Christian hat on. I do think there is a spiritual dimension to this. You know, I have heard people I've worked with, gamblers for a long time, say nothing good really happens to ordinary little old me. The experience of a jackpot in front of the pokies is not just the win, it is, wow, the gods, whoever they are up there, saw me, blessed me, rewarded me. I'm somebody. There's a whole lot of things going on at a whole lot of levels here.
Yeah, fascinating thought. And so, I mean, just the practical question that I'm sure this conversation is leading to, how can we help someone who has a gambling addiction or is going down that road?
It's really hard. You know, responsible service of alcohol will intervene with someone who's in a pub and has drunk too much. A person with a drug addiction, you'll see the physical effects, the bodily effects. With a gambling addiction, there's none of that. That's why there's no ever intervention, even if you've been sitting in front of a machine at the pokies for 4 hours, because you're talking fine. There's no slurred speech. There's nothing.
Hmm.
The truth is, helping someone with gambling is really saying, here are a range of different programs because people have different needs. Narcotics Anonymous, a 12-step program, Gamblers Help, a personal counselling, and almost certainly it is getting them to the first step of admitting, actually, this is out of control.
Mm.
Just admitting that, because it's not out of control if I'm going to have a win tomorrow and I don't have a problem, you see.
Yeah.
I really only have a time delay challenge. Tomorrow it'll be different.
Yeah.
So admitting that you have got a problem. And then almost certainly it's delving into issues around shame and significance and what I was saying earlier, ordinary little old me and nothing good ever happens. So there is a whole lot of psycho-spiritual issues to deal with once you're actually getting help. But even when you've got help, and this is true of so many people, you know, many gamblers can't go to the football, even take their kids, though they love the football, because an ad comes up on the scoreboard and it triggers them again. They can't watch it, you know, because it's everywhere. This is what is so unfair, even for those who are reformed gamblers. It's literally like being a reformed alcoholic and every night coming home and, you know, your wife's handed out beers to you and watch. You know, as soon as you turn on the TV, there's the gambling ads. It's really hard.
Yeah, man. Well, let's shift gears and move to some of the other issues that you've been passionate about over your journey. One of those has been connected with Micah Australia, so looking at things like immigration and global justice. And that's like immigration has been quite politically volatile for some time now. And many on the right, like right-leaning side of politics, which would have a strong Christian representation, are quite anti-immigration. So how do you respond to some of these concerns?
Yeah, Micah doesn't really weigh in on the immigration question, but on the refugee question, absolutely. So I'm very proud that when Kabul and Afghanistan fell to the Taliban, Micah organised a campaign called Christians United for Afghanistan. And we asked the Morrison government for 20,000 extra places for Afghani Muslims. Now, you don't often hear Christians arguing for Muslims. Less often do you hear the whole of the Christian church united in arguing for 20,000 places for Muslims. And I mean, Australian Christian Lobby and Wendy Francis, who was the director there, came with me to see Scott Morrison, to all the heads of churches, really led by the Micah women leaders. So Micah women pastors are the relational advocacy experts. They know how to do relational advocacy. Men are okay. Some are good. But men are often a bit self-important as church leaders, chest out, knees under the table. Look at how my church programs, the size of my church. Women have this authenticity, emotional intelligence, passion. When Scott Morrison and as Prime Minister and Alex Hawke as Immigration Minister saw a united church, they gave 16,000 extra places at a cost of $650 million for what were Afghani Muslims fleeing the Taliban here to Australia. So I'm very, very proud of that.
Yeah.
Look, the immigration question is a different question, but for Christians to actually say Jesus was a refugee, that the children of Israel escaping Egypt were refugees, that again and again, over 26 times in the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, it's incredible. God's, the prophets and the law says, God's face is seen in the stranger.
Yeah.
A refugee. We cannot escape this because as Christians, we've always been internationalist. We believe the image of God is in everyone. Whatever their religion or background, ethnicity, sexuality, disability. Actually, this is lifting us above tribalism, just my mob, and we close the borders. We don't have a responsibility. Christian faith, starting with Paul saying neither Jew nor Gentile, how incredibly radical that was. Lifting us above tribalism and just my type, they're the only ones I have an ethical duty to. So, yes, there can be debate in the Christian circles about this, but when push comes to shove, as we saw with Christians United for Afghanistan, I've been very, very proud of the whole of the Christian church, from right to left to in the middle. There's all those political expressions in the church, but they were united.
Yeah. So another thing that has created more global instability has been the way that America has intentionally abandoned their responsibilities as a global citizen and instead adopted quite a strong isolationist position. And so here I'm thinking about USAID, so something that was close to your heart, something that you've written about recently. Tell us about USAID and like the global charity initiatives that have been affected by that. Well, I guess tell us what happened with the gutting of USAID, AID, and then some of the impact that that's had.
Yeah, so Trump never mentioned in his campaigning that he intended to effectively abolish USAID, AID, pull $54 billion out of the international system for the world's poorest. And when he won power, the first agency Elon Musk went out after was USAID. I was in Kenya in Nairobi slums with women clinicians. They're all poor Kenyan women doctors in tears, sending away HIV-positive women who are pregnant with ARVs, antiretrovirals. They can deliver a non-positive child. They were in tears sending them away, saying it's almost a death sentence. And we know that because USAID, thanks to George W. Bush, you know, people do not realise that of all the US presidents, the president who did most for the world's poor, particularly Africans, was George W. Bush. Mm. His PEPFAR, Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, has saved 27 million lives in Africa alone.
Yeah.
All of that destroyed by another Republican president, Donald Trump. We know that some 1,300,000 people will now die this year from HIV because of that. And this is from pro-life Republicans. We know that when it comes to vaccines, some 500,000 people depended on the contribution of USAID for vaccines, won't get them and will die. The pull of food humanitarian funding from USAID will see some 300,000 die. It is dreadful. And I was in Kenya and then in Uganda, literally before my very eyes, seeing that TB, malaria, ARVs, antiretrovirals, had disappeared from the clinics, from the hospitals, because it was so savage, it was so cruel. And, you know, I just take profound exception to this because it wasn't a stated policy. It's cruel for the richest man in the world, worth $400 billion himself, Elon Musk, to do it. And it's literally thrown the international development system, which is very collaborative. So many of us, you know, the World Visions and Christian organizations partner with USAID. So many governments, our DFAT program partners with them, thrown into chaos because no warning. They have a review to say, oh, well, there's some questionable programs in USAID. We'll defund those. Absolutely fine, but not this. Elon Musk on the Joe Rogan podcast said, the fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy. Now, as a Christian, I believe the Christian gospel and Jesus has been a profound shaping influence on Western civilization. Mm. I would say the fundamental strength of Western civilization is empathy. And to see this happen, and to cost lives. And I wrote a piece in the Sydney Morning Herald 5 weeks ago about how cruel this is, having just got back from Kenya and Uganda, and it's happening around the world. It's profoundly shocking. So Micah is campaigning on that. We're very pleased that in the budget, I was up there last week when the budget was handed down. I'd been the heads of all Christian denominations had written a letter to Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese pleading not to cut aid, not to follow America, pointing out even apart from the moral humanitarian reasons, China still has an aid program, and they're in our region in the Pacific. The America has vacated it. The geopolitical security risk. Yes, we all know defence spending has to increase, but we know, as General Mattis said, head of defence in Trump's first administration, when Trump, you know, thought aloud, a thought bubble, oh, maybe I'll cut aid. Mattis said, if you cut aid, you will have to buy me lots more bullets. You know, it's not just defence for security, it's defence and development. Without development, girls in school and hope, you get inequality, conflict, unrest. You get it in our region. I was very pleased in the budget that the Labor government increased aid by $136 million. Literally, for me, it was praise God.
Yeah.
That's life-saving aid. And I do hope, we haven't heard Peter Dutton's plans, I do hope the coalition in this election do not cut aid.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked a few specific issues now, but let's get in the helicopter and look at a broader societal issue. I want to focus on something that's deeply affecting our civil discourse and the way we approach charity, activism, social justice, these kinds of things, and that is the label of wokeness. Now, I'm not going to lie. Personally, I can't stand the term. I think it's a vague and unserious and lazy catch-all word that seeks to paint all non-conservative views and causes with the same brush. But at the same time, it's seemingly stuck in a way that other terms haven't over the years. And so clearly it's tapping into something that people are feeling. And the bit I want to ask you about is the kind of downstream effect of this, where this language can just be thrown at all kinds of initiatives. And it really does like discredit really valuable social justice programs. And I just want to ask you, what would you say to someone that called you and the things that you champion woke, if that was to happen?
Oh, well, I'm in very good company with the Hebrew prophets and Jesus. Right through the scriptures, it's awake and let your light shine. Through church history, the Reformation is an awakening. It's woke. It's actually saying, let's get back to not all the accretions of penance and indulgences and buying salvation. We are now awake, and Luther and others use this language. I actually think that there are things where the left have overreached that make me very uncomfortable. I am uncomfortable about men transitioning to women in women's sport. I don't like it. If people are talking about that and saying, you're woke, Tim, well, actually, on that, I disagree. I am troubled. I'm very troubled about puberty blockers on young people, sometimes even without their parents knowing. I just think, no. Adolescence is a really confusing time, and medical interventions which have permanent effects, I don't like. And after the Tavistock Institute in London stopped doing that, I actually think there's a real argument that this should not be happening. So there are parts where I think the left really has overreached. But I think Tom Holland, who's a wonderful secular historian, he's written a book, though, on how the cross influenced Western civilization. And essentially he's saying that Jesus dying on the cross shaped Western civilization in this way. It changed all the sensibilities to say God encourages an ethical vision from the perspective of the vulnerable and the victim. The person dying on the cross is the vulnerable and the victim. In Jesus' case, the innocent victim. Holland would say that the culture wars going on are actually in some ways a Christian civil war. That Me Too, women saying no longer will I be harassed by wealthy millionaires who just get away with it, is part of the Christian vision, you know. The what seems like strange to secular ears, morality of Christians about premarital sex, faithfulness in marriage, were actually liberating for women because women's bodies in Greco-Roman world were owned by men. owned by masters. These were liberating sexual mores to empower women. Likewise, Me Too is liberating for women. Black Lives Matter. But the Christian community in fighting this civil war often doesn't hear each other. I have great sympathy for Christians who are fighting against abortion. They're saying the fetus is vulnerable, and we will speak for the fetus. This is an ethical vision from the point of view of the vulnerable. But equally, some who will argue they're pro-choice say, but women were given agency by Christianity. In a Greco-Roman world, they did not have agency, certainly not over their own bodies, because men ruled. Therefore, pro-choice, giving women agency, is important. Actually, both are an ethical perspective. It just depends who you decide which is the victim and the most vulnerable. On that issue of abortion, I think the left often overreaches. It worries me that you can sometimes hear secular voices treat abortion as if it's just a form of contraception, as if there's no moral issues involved. I believe there are moral issues involved, very profound moral issues. But as soon as you frame the question, are you pro-life or pro-choice, you're going to end up, I think, with some of the wrong answers. It's always more complex. A 13-year-old girl in a red state in America who is raped and now pregnant and can't actually have a termination. Well, it's not as simple as saying pro-life, pro-life. She has to deliver that baby. It is always more complex. It is always messy. So I think the term woke is thrown around a bit too casually. I always say to people who use the word, well, are you denying that climate change actually is real and therefore I'm woke because I believe it's real? Are you calling me woke because I have empathy for refugees? What actually do you mean? It's just become a catch-all for anyone. Anyone whose views irritates me must be woke. It's become a catch-all.
Yeah. So in Australia, we're coming up to our federal election. You've spoken a bit about this stuff in the media recently. And one thing that I think would be worth chatting about is the role of supporting good policy with your vote, if you can, or as much as you can. Because they do have a real effect on the country that elects their leaders, their parties, etc. But they have an even bigger effect on minority groups and the poor and the vulnerable. So it is a consideration that we should take seriously. And I just want to ask, do you have advice for people when it comes to their vote? And maybe you could separate this like for a secular audience, any advice there, but then also for Christians. Is there any particular advice you'd give to a Christian in approaching elections?
Yeah, look, I would address both audiences and say that, one, we are so blessed to have compulsory voting and an independent electoral system. The profound polarization in America, and I go there each year, and I'm deeply shocked at how much blue and red hate each other's guts, cannot even have a conversation. And part of the reason is because without compulsory voting, both blue and red Democrat and Republican parties, to get the vote out, have to preach really extreme things about the other side, catastrophes and enemies and evil. And that's just to mobilize the vote, just to get people to be scared enough, motivated enough to go out and vote. I think we're really blessed that in Australia, I hope that level of polarization never comes here, and compulsory voting is one of the reasons. Equally, the states, whether they're blue or red, those states set their own election rules. They even set their electoral boundaries. It's appalling. It's not objective like our Australian Electoral Commission. So no wonder everything is so politicized and polarized. You just really can't trust the system. So I do think Australia starts ahead, and I do think whether you're secular or people of faith, to be grateful for our system, to say now, generations ago, our forebears fought for the right to vote. I think it's really important to exercise it. I don't think there's a right and wrong vote. I think you work it out by saying, what actually are the priorities? As you've been hearing this interview, my priorities always start with those in Australia who are poorest. And it includes actually those who don't get to vote, dependent on Australian aid, whose lives and we're sustaining and giving hope. But I always start with those policies. Look, starting with those policies, you can arrive at different conclusions. You could say, well, massive tax cuts maybe for the rich, as Trump's promising in America, would get more investment, more jobs. The poor might benefit from that. You might say, okay, I'm still concerned for the poor, but I think this is the best way to do that. That then requires certain judgments about policy, actually. Do I believe in trickle down? What do I believe about a safety net here, which can't be so safe that it cuts the nerve of individual responsibility and getting off my couch and working hard? We're always balancing those policy calls. But for me, it starts with what Jesus preached. He preached, I've come to declare good news for the poor. That's where I start.
You mentioned hope there, and let's frame our final question around hope. I initially wanted to ask you something about heaven and what you're looking forward to most. And I was thinking, like mostly as a joke, that you'll be like uniquely out of a job compared to many of the rest of us. And maybe that's the point of the way that you carry yourself.
I hope it is.
Admirable. But I'll instead ask, how can people stay hopeful when times are looking pretty dire, when the mountain of problems and opposition just seems too big? If someone wanted to get involved in a cause or try and start something new, what would you say to them?
So I am in great grief at the moment, grief because of the suffering and what will be needless deaths from USAID being smashed. It's virtually impossible to put $54 billion back into the world's poorest communities. But I am trying to distinguish grief from despair. I'm determined not to allow my grief to become despair. Despair is a black tunnel which cuts the nerve of acting. And this is why, for me, faith is so fundamental to all that I do. I am determined to look up and see a God of hope, a God of justice, a God who hasn't given up on this world, so I'm not going to give up on this world. I believe hope isn't a feeling. I believe hope is a choice. I choose to hope. I choose to hope. And that for me is the basis of why I go on to your question of anyone thinking of starting something. Absolutely. Choose to hope. It's not just a Pollyanna. You know, some people are optimistic, some are pessimistic. We must choose hope, even when the evidence seems against us. I choose to hope, and that's because I believe in a God of hope.
Terrific. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Tim. Really appreciate you making the time for us in this particularly busy season for you. Keep up the great work you do, and God bless.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
What does the Christian faith look like in action? Well, it probably depends who you ask, but I know that many Christians have deeply valued making a positive difference in their local communities and the world where they can. I think of great humanitarians like Mother Teresa or Catherine and William Booth, who started the Salvation Army. I think of the abolitionists William Wilberforce, John Newton and Frederick Douglass. I think of civil rights champions like Martin Luther King Jr. and Desmond Tutu. I think of Florence Nightingale, who professionalised nursing, or Lord Shaftesbury, who pushed for labour reforms that protected children during the Industrial Revolution. I think of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and his courage to stand against the Nazi regime and their demented vision for humanity. And these are just some of the more well-known ones. Across history and the globe, there would have been thousands, if not millions, of other faithful Christians who have made it their life mission to help those in need, to fight injustice, and to add just one more brick to building a better world with more opportunities for more people in more places. Whether it's helping those in poorer countries, promoting civil and human rights, education, religious freedom, prison reform, healthcare, advancing Indigenous reconciliation efforts, fighting racism, sexism, ableism, defending the rights of children and the unborn, opposing slavery in the past or in the modern sense. Or it could be some of the things Tim and I spoke about: gambling reform, gun restrictions, global aid, addressing homelessness and drug addiction, welcoming refugees, or warning of climate change. We all have things that occupy our mind, stir our heart, and compel us to act. And typically, Christians have had an outsized role and impact in pioneering this work. Even today, faith-based charities continue to have a massive impact in Australia, with Christian organisations continuing to be integral to Australia's charitable sector, contributing significantly to education, healthcare, and social services nationwide. And this is the same Christianity that helped change the world. But at the same time, there's almost always been internal resistance too. Sometimes that resistance has been appropriate. Not every new idea is a good idea, after all. But sometimes it's been to our shame. We've failed to act, failed to care, failed to love our fellow man. And it's been for typically human reasons. For selfish, political, ignorant, fearful, or hateful reasons. And we'll get into the history of some of this stuff on our next and final episode. But the point is this. As Christians, we are called to love our neighbours and our enemies. We are to be the Good Samaritans. It's our duty to show love in word and deed, which is incredibly demanding and difficult and inconvenient, but deeply rewarding and something that helps others see and experience the love of God through his people. And I know for those listening to this podcast who are skeptical, it's not unreasonable to expect Christians to be doing this stuff. Anyone who has picked up a Bible and read one of the Gospels can see what Jesus was like. Tim mentioned empathy, and when you encounter Jesus, it's undeniable how much his heart, empathy, and compassion for people jump out of the pages of the Bible in an inspiring way, perfectly complementing his beautiful, provocative, and evergreen teachings. He saw the marginalized, he touched the untouchable, and he dined with those society had cast aside. He didn't just offer sympathy, he stepped into people's suffering, and he calls us to do the same. Empathy isn't about agreeing with every perspective. It's about seeing the humanity in others, understanding their pain, and being willing to walk alongside them. When we discuss social justice issues, our first response shouldn't be judgment, but compassion. Who is suffering? What burdens are they carrying? And how can we, as the people of Christ, bear those burdens with them? Now, empathy alone won't fix things either, but it's an important precursor to acting and alleviating one's pain where possible. James chapter 2 verses 15 and 16 challenges Christians with this. Suppose a brother or a sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, "Go in peace, keep warm and well fed," but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? Faith without deeds is dead. Social justice isn't a distraction from the gospel. It's a reflection of it. And too often, acts of compassion and advocacy are dismissed as merely being woke, reducing temporal justice to a political stance rather than a core tenet of our faith. But Christian charity and action transcend political labels. They're not about aligning with an ideology, but about embodying Christ's call to love, to serve, and uplift those in need, to care for the poor, welcome the stranger, and seek justice for the oppressed. We serve a God who sees injustice and responds with impartial love, and we're invited to do the same. Whether that means advocating for fairer policies, supporting organisations that help the vulnerable, or simply listening to someone's story with an open heart, we're called to be present, to care, and to act, whoever we come across. And this is powerful. It turns statistics into stories, strangers into neighbours, and abstract issues into personal convictions. It moves us from apathy to action, from indifference to love, reminding us that behind every issue is a person, a family, a community that God deeply loves. So the question is this: do we want to build systems that reflect justice, mercy, and love? Or do we want to burn it all down because some billionaire or YouTuber tells us it's bad? Efficiency is an important part of being a good steward, but it shouldn't be anyone's core value, much less a Christian. And yeah, charity is wasteful. It's not going to turn a profit. That's the whole point. God sees intrinsic value beyond our utility or growth potential or bang for buck. We're more than a resource to be allocated, a payroll liability, or what we deserve in scare quotes. You see, greed and grace are fundamentally opposed. And I know which side God is on. So let's be a people and society of grace. Let's be thoughtful about the kind of world we want to live in. Let's not be captured by hollow and deceptive ideologies that seduce us with a scarcity mentality when abundance is on offer. Life doesn't have to be a zero-sum game with our neighbours, to put it in gambling terms from before. Moral philosopher Nicholas Waltersdorf talks about this in his book Justice in Love. He says this, "Often in scripture one finds the injunction, do not harden your heart. Our disposition to compassion is easily inhibited. Among the most powerful inhibitors being the stories we tell ourselves about the members of some outgroup. They are no better than animals, we say, undermining our life, one and all, they are evil." When a person's heart has been hardened by an inhibiting story in this way, confrontation with suffering evokes no compassion. But this story that hardens the heart must be contested. So let's do that. Let's find that better story by reading the better story, and then finding those without the megaphone. Asking a good question might not change someone's circumstances, but it can change our own hearts and dispositions. During the interview, Tim spoke about what drove him as he transitioned from Urban Seed to World Vision. And it was based around seeing a familiar question pop up again and again. Do I matter? Will anyone notice me? And for many, it's an overwhelming question, particularly if you feel powerless, overlooked, forgotten, scorned. But as Tim said, God sees you. God sees all of us, and all of us matter in his eyes. He smiles down on us. The image of God is bared by all of us, and whoever we are, our shame can be taken away. And if that doesn't motivate you, well, I don't know what will. My deep hope is that if you're someone in pain, someone in need, that you'll be seen by Christians too, and that you'll experience the people living out what the Lord requires of us, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. It might not seem like much, but it's a winning hand if you ask me. Thanks for listening to Deeper Questions. We're closing in on the final episode of the show. And if you found this particular episode helpful or thought-provoking, then why not share it with a friend or leave us a review, send us an email. I'm sure you know the drill by now. I'd also encourage you to check out our website at thirdspace.org.au. We have a bunch of other resources available, as well as some new communities starting up where you can chat with the group in person or online about these kinds of questions. This has been Deeper Questions. I'm your host, Aaron Johnstone. Submerge in wonder, surface with hope.